Explain what a circadian neuroscientist is and what our natural circadian rhythms are.
Well, I'm interested in internal time. What we all have is an internal body clock, which is almost like a day within. And what this internal clock does is fine-tune, adjust every aspect of our physiology and behaviour to the varied demands of rest, activity, the sleep-wake cycle. So in anticipation of waking up in the morning, you know, core body temperature goes up, metabolism goes up, so that when dawn arrives, we can get out there and exploit the new environment appropriately and optimally. And so I'm interested in the processes within the brain that generate this internal clock, and particularly how they're regulated by light.
Can we go back? How did cavemen sleep? How many hours would a caveman have slept?
That's an interesting question, and we can only guess. What we can do is go back to the medieval era and look at societies today where there's no electric light. And the sleep patterns seem to be very different. I mean, in some tribal populations without electric light in South America, there's about a two-hour settling down at dusk, sort of a quiet relaxation, 4 hours of consolidated sleep. Then people wake up, interact, then another 4 hours of sleep, and then a slow two-hour transition out. And so
they're waking up in the middle of the night.
Yeah, and in fact, it may be more than once. And so the sort of what we try and achieve, which is a solid eight-hour block, might be rather artificial because we're compressing an extended sleep episode into a much sort of narrower a window of time.
So I don't feel so silly waking up at 3:30 every morning.
No, and that's really important because many people wake up and think, oh my goodness, that's it. I'm never going to get back to sleep. Start drinking coffee, start doing the emails. And if you just relax, often just leave the bed, keep the light low, do something relaxing. You'll feel tired and then you can return to bed. Don't lie there feeling frustrated.
So are we all disrupting our circadian rhythms then?
There's a lot of evidence that we are. I mean, in 1800, 98-95% of the population worked outside. We were agricultural workers. And so we got that robust exposure to the light-dark cycle. Since we've moved inside, we've become almost a light-deprived species. We don't get that daily, you know, dawn-dusk exposure, which sets the clock to the local time environment. So we're all sort of drifting and a bit wobbly.
And that would be why you hear people advise to fight, the pain that comes with long distance travel, even though you didn't have it. It's best to get outside and be in the sunlight or the moonlight, whatever
That's
it is.
That's the primary way in which we reset our body clock to the local time environment is exposure to the light dark cycle.
Yeah, interesting. All right, and we can't all be the same, obviously. I mean, so in Winston Churchill's case, did he only need 5 hours sleep a night?
Well, in fact, there's some quotes from his wife, Clemmy, and she said, as long as Winston gets 8 hours overall, he's fine.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there are notoriously short sleepers like Margaret Thatcher. And I think that under certain circumstances, it might be useful, but I think we need to know what the costs are. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're more likely to forget stuff. Mm-hmm. You won't process information properly. You won't lay down memories. And it's so much of what we do when we're asleep is important to our ability to function during the day. Processing of information, coming up with novel ideas to complex problems is something that's actually going on in the brain while we sleep. If you don't get the sleep, you can be much more sort of impulsive. And less reflective, and you lack empathy. You don't pick up those social signals in others that are telling you something's not quite right.
And so then, if we're wrong about Winston Churchill, I suspect I'm wrong also about Leonardo da Vinci. Did he sleep 15 minutes in the hour? Was that his pattern?
Certainly some people have tried that. But the problem with all of these stories is that people are very... Unless you can measure it objectively, one's subjective view of one's sleep is not very good. And in fact, you know, there are people that go around and say, oh, I only need 4 hours or I only need 5 hours. The problem is the tired brain is so impaired, it doesn't know how impaired it is.
Right.
So you're screwing up, but you don't know you're screwing up.
So there is a long-term mental well-being issue here.
There's a serious long-term mental health issue with sleep. And we know that if you are a poor sleeper, then that greatly increases your risk of depression and anxiety and various conditions. And some research that we've done in Oxford has shown that if you can partially consolidate sleep in vulnerable individuals, you reduce some of the severity of the psychiatric symptoms. So you can think of sleep as a therapeutic target. Stabilize sleep and you can reduce some of the psychiatric problems.
Professor Russell Foster is a circadian neuroscientist. On the text, a good one here from Anna. She wants to know if sleep has the same value before and after midnight. You get asked that a lot, don't you?
Yeah, but that's tricky. In fact, the sleep sleep varies over the entire sleep period. So for the first episode of sleep, it's deeper sleep. And that's where memory consolidation and the processing of information seems to occur. So it may well be that the first part of our sleep is more important for memorization and the processing of information. The second half of sleep seems to be associated more with emotional processing, but it's still early days. I mean, that sort of kind of fits with the data, but I wouldn't sort of bet on it too strongly.
You'll be part of this summit, as we've mentioned, in Karratha, and the reason for it is that you're going to be looking at the impact of shift work, which is something that we know very well in Western Australia with a huge mining sector and a lot of fly-in, fly-out. What are some of the methods that you would look to asking shift workers to employ in order to get better sleep?
This is a really important summit by RPH, Research Foundation, here based in Perth. And so I think 97% of night shift workers, even if they've been on the night shift for a long time, do not shift their body clock with the demands of working at night. And that's because of light. Essentially, it's relatively dim light in the factory or in the workplace, but then bright light on the journey home. And so the clock always defers to the brighter light signal as being daytime. So you're not going to cure jet lag in that sense. And long-term night shift is associated with not only sort of the mental health problems we've touched on, but also cardiovascular problems, diabetes 2, metabolic abnormalities, and even the risk of cancer, higher risk of cancer. Mm. So what we've got to do is mitigate some of those problems. And what's interesting is that the mining industry is now taking this very seriously. It sort of recognises there's a duty of care. And what we're going to discuss are ways in which, for example, we improve nutrition. If there's a high rate of obesity, metabolic abnormalities, what are we giving for food for our night shift workers? If there's a high risk of these health problems, we should institute higher health checks, or high frequency health checks. If there's an increased chance of a crash after the night shift on the journey home, then let's use monitoring devices on the dashboard that let you know you're falling asleep. So it's issues that we can deal with now to mitigate some of the problems of shift work.
And how important is a dark bedroom then for a shift worker?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Light, of course, not only sets the body clock, but it increases levels of alertness. And so we need to minimise light when you're trying to sleep so that you're much more likely to go off to sleep. Half an hour before you go to sleep, you should be really beginning to wind down. So minimise light exposure, because as we've just said, increased light increases alertness, and that will delay sleep onset. Turn off devices, turn the mobile off, turn the email off, stop watching TV, and start to do things that are relaxing. It may well be listening to some quiet, relaxing music. It may be reading a few pages of a book. And some people, for example, have a warm bath. And all of these things sort of wind you down. I think the transition from wake to sleep is such a profound physiological shift that it can't be done instantly. And so we sort of have to sort of ease ourselves into sleep. Dark bedroom, very important. Also, the bedroom shouldn't be too hot. So recommendation is between 18 and 22 degrees. I mean, I like an 18 degree bedroom. I like it nice and cool. And that's probably important because as we begin to sleep, we lose a little bit of core body temperature. And if it's too hot, we can't lose that core body temperature. And that may prevent us from going off to sleep too easily.
Can I ask a question? An afternoon nap, how does that fit into a sleep pattern?
So the data suggests that a short nap, 20 minutes or so, is fine. If you go longer than that, you can go into deeper sleep. And then the sort of the recovery from a deep sleep into consciousness again, you can be so sluggish, then you lose some of the benefits of that nap. But a 20-minute nap has shown that some people can be better able to cope during the second part of the day.
I've got to vouch for that because I often do that a couple of times a week. I do get up at 3:30 in the morning to be at work by 4:30. And I will lie on a couch or on a bed, just on top, on my back. I set my alarm and I will literally do 25 minutes and I wake up feeling fine. I think I only probably fall asleep for 10,
yeah.
But I still will go to bed at the normal time that night. I'm not then up till midnight. So it works for me, I've got to say.
And it does for many. The problem with napping, and school children are a good example of this, teenagers, they will go to bed late, they'll go to school tired, they'll get home from school, then they'll take a two-hour nap.
Mm.
And what that will do is push back the time that they will sleep at night by a significant amount. So then the alarm clock is driving them out of bed in the morning after shortened sleep. They wake up tired. They'll need a nap. And you have to be careful you don't get longer and longer naps and later bedtimes.
Can I ask you a question about melatonin? There's been lots of listeners asking what your thoughts are on it. It is widely available and used in the US. You don't need a script for it. You can buy whatever power of it in whatever form you want. But in Australia, it's more difficult to get.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Same in the UK. So what we know about melatonin, it's a biological marker of the dark. It's released at night, and it probably helps the light signal going into the biological clock. It probably reinforces the light signal by providing a biological dark signal. So it partially stabilizes. And in about 70% of people, it can have a slight sleep inductive effect. So if you take 3 milligrams of melatonin, it can reduce the time it takes you to get to sleep. However, it's not a very powerful agent. So it's a mild modulator of sleep, and it is not, as many people have called it, the sleep hormone.
Right. And so its use is not harmful? I mean, people worry about, you know, people give it to their children day after day after day. Is that wrong?
I think taking any medication day after day after day is probably not wise.
Yeah.
And I think you need to use, you know, your normal behavioural systems to try and regulate your own sleep.